Neil deGrasse Tyson has a new book out today. You may know him as director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, or from his show Cosmos, or from his many books and TV appearances. Tyson is an astrophysicist who often examines how science intersects with society. His new book, written with researcher Avis Lang, is called Accessory to War: The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military. Neil deGrasse Tyson joins us now from New York. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks. And I love the name Here and Now. Then I think, is there another show, There and Then? You know,
well, that's what people call us when they're angry at something that we've done. They go, oh, what is this, There and Then? So when did the connection between astrophysics and the military begin?
In my own mind or in reality?
In reality. Has it always been that way?
Oh, it's always been that way. So a military has a sort of modern sense of invocation. But if you look at the behaviors of sovereign states, if they wanted to expand their territory, they would need to do so in a way where they knew where they were going and where they came from geographically. And to accomplish this, you needed navigation. Navigation is something you did by the stars, the sun, moon, and stars. That would give you an indication of where you were on Earth and what you would need to do to get back to where you came. And who knew the sun, moon, and stars at any given time but the astronomers? We knew the sun, moon, and stars. We cared about timings. We cared about clocks. We had interests that greatly resonated with the empire-building ambitions of nations that had that as a goal.
Well, and you write that when these voyages would go out onto the seas, they would bring astronomers with them so that they could know where they were going.
Yeah, if not astronomers, then the tools of the astronomer that were handed over to them to then be invoked. And in a relatively modern expression of this, let's fast forward from antiquity to the 1760s. We have the voyages of Captain Cook. And you say, oh, how much do people really know about it? I'll tell you what we know a lot, right? So why did he go to the South Pacific? Great Britain sent him there. There was a transit of the planet Venus, which means when seen from Earth, Venus crosses in front of the disk of the sun in the sky. That lineup only happens once every couple hundred years or so. In that particular time, 1770, it was only visible from the South Pacific. So England said, Captain Cook, why don't you go observe this? This is great. It's science. It's measurement. And if you do that, you can calculate like how far away the planets are from each other in the solar system. There'll be an advance in astronomy. Okay, fine. Oh, wait a minute. Flip the page over. Oh, while you're out there, Here are some new navigation tools. Map the coastline of every landmass that you discover. And within two decades of that voyage, Great Britain took control of Australia, Northern Australia, New Zealand, and a whole host of other small island states in that region. The growth of the British Empire was enabled by this expedition to observe the transit of Venus and to test out these new navigational tools that were developed by astronomers.
Well, you say flip the page. What was the primary motivation of that trip, though?
It was a science expedition.
It was a science expedition. It wasn't.
If you ask, you say, why are you doing this? Oh, it's a science expedition.
Right.
The flip side. While you're there, why don't you do this? Yes. That's right. And so that information was then exploited by the British Empire to become an even bigger empire.
You also point out that the moon landing, which we think of as a scientific mission to some degree,
really wasn't.
It was about domination.
Yeah. So we remember the Kennedy speech that contains the words, we will put a man on the moon, return him safely to Earth before the decade is out. Nothing is as grand as a great. It's stirring words from a young president who's represented the modern era. And you felt like it's in your DNA as an American that we're explorers and we're discoverers. However, that same speech, which was a speech he gave to the joint session of Congress in May of 1961, 6 weeks after Yuri Gagarin had just come out of orbit, and we didn't have any vessel that could take a human into space without blowing up on the launch pad. He says, if the events of recent weeks, he wouldn't even mention the guy's name, if the events of recent weeks are any indication of the impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere, then we need to show the world the path to freedom over the path to tyranny. That was the battle cry against godless communists. Oh, by the way, we're going to go to the moon. Okay? And so once the battle cry was in place, that loosened a source of money that is available when you feel threatened. It's the war driver for spending money. And that's why we went to the moon. And that's why nobody should be surprised that when we learned Russia is not going to, the Soviet Union was not going to the moon, that we just ended it all. If you looked at when we were going to the moon, the writings were, oh, we're on the moon by 1969. We'll be on Mars by 1985. And this is where we're going. And this is why we're doing. No, no. The only reason why we'd be on Mars is if Russia wanted to put bases on Mars. And all astronauts in the Apollo era, except for one, were military pilots. They were from the Navy and from the Marines and from the Air Force. So even though it was a civilian agency. So who are we kidding to think that the motivation was – now, by the way, since we're going to the moon, hey, you guys, why don't you take this little experiment with you?
Oh, grab some rocks. Bring them back.
Here's a satchel. Here's a shopping bag. Bring back some rocks. So we can analyze it and don't mess them up too badly when you do it. And here, so yes, science happened, but that's not what drove it. And that's not why we did it. But science did happen. And science historically has always piggybacked geopolitically driven activities.
International Space Station, you'd say the same about the International Space Station?
Oh, yeah. So in the 1980s, which is when the internet – well, it was called Space Station Freedom back then. It wasn't international. It was our space station. Mm-hmm. This is the Cold War. Russia was going to have a space station. We're going to have a space station. So we start building the space station. Then 1989 comes around. Peace breaks out in Europe. And by 1993, it's official. And we say, uh-oh, how about all these Russian space scientists? They're really talented. And we don't want them going to an adversary. So we invited Russia to join us in Space Station Freedom. Then it became the International Space Station. So all these decisions were geopolitically motivated. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, you can do science in zero G.
So when you look at this, do you say this is a good thing that these two things are mixed, that this is a bad thing, or that this is just these are the facts of life and this is how we're going to do space exploration?
Yeah, I don't value judge it. It's hard to not value judge something like this, but I've worked hard to not value judge it. For me, compiling this book, looking at the role that science in general and astrophysics in particular has played in aiding the warfighter, I stepped aside and I said, I will not pass judgment on this. I will simply present it as is. The reader can judge it, they like it or dislike it, but it's what it is. So it's your third choice. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just what it is.
Facts of life. So
yes.
You talk about Reagan's Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, which is about missile defense. And there's long been question about whether it's effective at all. We don't really know. What do you think? Do you think that there's something to it that eventually we'll get it right, or do you think that it's not going anywhere?
No, as it was conceived in the day, it was pretty clear it would have never worked. And even if pieces of it worked, it would still have enough holes in it to not have worked well enough to have justified the exercise. I nonetheless applaud the idea that your Department of Defense would actually be doing things that are fundamentally defensive, that it's let us render their weapons obsolete by creating a shield that protects us under any circumstance. That's a good idea to have. The execution of it, and I agree with all the co-signatures on with whole pages of letters in the New York Times signed by Nobel laureates. Yes, that analysis was accurate, that it would have been a leaky system. I've been told by Republican confidants that the Republicans who were pushing that also knew that it would never work. But that didn't matter. All that mattered was that Russia would think it would work.
What do you think of Space Force, President Trump's idea for a sixth branch of the military?
Yeah, I don't have a horse in that race. I can tell you that if you ask generals in the Air Force – which currently oversee the U.S. Space Command, many of them will say, we're fine controlling space under the umbrella of an Air Force. But if you do break it off, what you do is you will shift everything under the Air Force's portfolio that's about space, and it becomes its own category, a Space Force. And I might throw in a couple of things if you could. I might throw in asteroid defense maybe, or how about cleaning up the space debris? So that my commerce that I'm conducting from space doesn't get put at risk by 18,000 mile an hour bolts flying through space that fell off of some mission. So I don't have a fundamental problem with it. And just because it came out of Trump's mouth doesn't make it crazy.
Now, we're talking about a new branch of the military. It seems that the current strategy on the part of the United States is to move toward privatization of a lot of space exploration. What does that mean for you if we do move more of our space exploration into private companies? How does that work with the idea that space is an important part of the military?
So that's a great, great question. So I have to clarify a couple of things that are not often clarified in the press, and that is private enterprise, based on my read of history, will never lead a venture into space that has never been conducted before. Things you've never done before that are expensive and dangerous and have uncertain returns on investment are simply not done by corporate entities. They're done by entities that have a longer baseline of return on the investment that they can recognize, and that would be nations, right? The first Europeans to the New World were not the Dutch East India Trading Company. It was Columbus, sent by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand to find a shorter trade route to the Far East. And once he's there and he knows how big the Earth is and how long it takes and where the hostels and the friendlies and the trade winds and the food, then you come back. Now you have information that can be used to assist an economic venture. So it's not really true that Elon Musk is going to send the first astronauts to Mars on his own dime. Oh, excuse me. You could do it as a vanity project. He could get together with Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, and they could just do it and drop, $100 billion to do it, whatever it'll cost. But that's not a business model. And they would be criticized by investors for having spent their money that way. So what you do is, here's how that could happen. The United States says we need to put a military base on Mars in reaction to some geopolitical force. Oh, we don't have a rocket that'll do that. Oh, SpaceX rolls out a Mars rocket. Thank you, SpaceX. We will buy your rocket from you, and we will send our astronauts to Mars on it. That's how Elon can get to Mars, because we'd be paying for it.
How are we doing when it comes to competition with China and Russia and other countries, by the way, India, in space exploration?
I was just in China visiting the largest telescope in the world. They've got the largest telescope in the world. And I came through the Shanghai airport where there's a sign that says, oh, bathrooms are this way and stairs are that way. Oh, and the maglev is this way.
Right. It's very fast, like 400 kilometers an hour or something.
Thank you. The maglev on the same sign as the bathroom and the stairs. And I'm thinking, if I had a maglev, it'd be the biggest freaking sign in the airport. Okay. So there's a magnetically levitated train that goes, several hundred kilometers an hour, and it goes from the airport to the city in just a matter of minutes. And so I'm disappointed that here we are in the United States arguing over who's going to build a wall and who, what immigrant is coming in or not, when there are large issues related to things like infrastructure and energy policy and food management and research in the frontier of science, technology, engineering, and math, which will fuel tomorrow's economic growth. Without that, we'll just watch the rest of the world pass us by, as they're kind of already doing. We're becoming less and less relevant on the world stage. So I fear for the future of the United States.
If we do encounter aliens, how likely do you think it is that we'll get into? Well, how likely do you think it is that we'll get into a fight with them?
Oh, if they come to us, you ever see a sci-fi movie where some alien thing shows up, and it's some huge spaceship, and people pull out their gun and shoot at it?
No,
and I just laugh.
Right.
I say, people, they came here in a spaceship from deep space. You think your gun is going to have any effect on them at all? And so
They have a force field around them. It's not going to work.
Right. Thank you. And this is me arguing at movies, right? So if they come here, they are certainly more technologically advanced than we are. If they treat us the way we treat one another, then they will completely exploit us, enslave us, put us on reservations, slaughter us. They will have their way with us if they treat us the way we humans have treated each other in the history of civilization. So we should hope that they are kinder and gentler than we are in dealing with us.
You talk about a lot of different inventions over time in this book, things that I don't even think about anymore, but like the telescope and, you know, radio waves and stuff like that, right? I mean, which I use every day, but it's like that is really amazing thing that somebody came up with that.
Discover this stuff. So, somebody discovered infrared.
Right.
I got to briefly tell you that experiment. It was brilliant. It was William Herschel. He's got this rainbow coming through the prism and the light through the window. He says, first brilliant point is, I wonder if the different colors of light have different temperatures. Mm-hmm. First, he's got to have that thought. So then he lays down thermometers in the different colors. But now he needs a control thermometer. So he puts it off to the side of the red part of the spectrum where there's no light. And now he measures the thermometers. And the highest temperature he recorded was the control thermometer off to the side of the red. That was not room temperature. It was something even higher. Mm-hmm. And he says, whoa, something's coming through that light and that prism that's landing there that I can't see. He uses the phrase unfit for vision. There is energy unfit for vision coming in below the red part of the spectrum, infrared. That was the discovery of infrared light.
So the question I was going to ask you is there something
–
now maybe I know the answer to it. Maybe it's infrared light. But is there something along the way that you've discovered that you think to yourself – how in the world did someone figure this out?
Well, so I read a lot in the history of people figuring stuff out. Sometimes it's serendipitous. Other times it's insight that's purposefully driven. Isaac Newton is a good example of that. And so, yeah, I marvel in the brilliance of those who have come before us just trying to decode the operations of nature. And we would later exploit them. Clever engineers say, I can exploit that new phenomenon that you just measured in some way that can serve us. I'll give you an example. My physics professor in college was an expert on nuclei of atoms in space. And in so doing, he discovered a new physical phenomenon called nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. It was a clever technologist who said, oh my gosh, I can make a machine using that principle and analyze your body and figure out what kinds of atoms are in what places in your soft tissue. Thus was born the magnetic resonance imager. Mm-hmm. Arguably one of the best tools in the arsenal of the doctor to analyze the condition of your body without cutting you open. That's based on a principle of physics discovered by a physicist who had no interest in medicine.
I want to ask you one more thing, which is, you know, scientists, and I've got two step-parents who are both physicists, and we've talked about this, that they have a hard time convincing members of Congress or lawmakers of why their research is important, why it needs to be funded, because a lot of these people, they're not scientists. I mean, a lot of our listeners, I'm not a scientist. It's hard to understand some of this stuff. You have become one of the preeminent scientists who can communicate with the masses. How important is that? Do you think there need to be more people like you that do what you do?
Should be thousands of people like me. I think there's tons of articulate scientists. Our profession, however, in general, does not reward us for being articulate in ways that take us outside of the laboratory. Mm-hmm. My field, we have the benefit of having had Carl Sagan clear some of the brush and bramble of this attitude against reaching for the public. Can you still be respected if you appear on The Tonight Show? Can you still be respected if you're a character in a cartoon? And that's an interesting question. And in my field, I've done all of those things. And as best as I can tell, I'm still respected, in part because I'm trying to lift all boats, raise science literacy of the entire electorate, so that when anyone comes back to their representative or to their community, they'll say, oh, are you doing that work? I saw Tyson talk about it. That's great. I want more of it. Mm. And if you're doing tax-based sourced science, as astrophysicists do, our monies come from primarily the National Science Foundation and from NASA. Both of them are funded by – the TILs are funded by tax monies. If that's the case, you have the right to know. I have the obligation to tell you, and you have the right to know how that money is being spent. And so I would do so without hesitation, sharing what the thrills of this. And this is what Carl Sagan did brilliantly in his original Cosmos and in all the books that surrounded it.
That's Neil deGrasse Tyson, whose new book is called Accessory to War, written with Avis Lang. Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on.